Penguin Presents After You by Jojo Moyes. Read by Anna Acton. Chapter 1. The big man at the end of the bar is sweating. He holds his head low over his double scotch, but every few minutes he glances up and out, behind him, towards the door. A fine sheen of perspiration glistens under the strip lights. He lets out a long, shaky breath disguised as a sigh and turns back to his drink.
Hey, excuse me.
I look up from polishing glasses.
Can I get another one here?
I want to tell him it's really not a good idea. It won't help. It might even put him over the limit. But he's a big guy, and it's 15 minutes till closing time, and according to company guidelines, I have no reason to tell him no. So I walk over, take his glass and hold it up to the optic. He nods at the bottle.
Double,
he says, and slides a fat hand down his damp face. That'll be £7.20, please. It's 11:15 on a Tuesday night, and the Shamrock and Clover, East City Airport's Irish-themed pub, which is as Irish as Mahatma Gandhi, is winding down for the night. The bar closes 10 minutes after the last plane takes off, and right now, it's just me, an intense young man with a laptop, the cackling women at table two, and the man nursing a double Jameson's, waiting for either the SC-107 to Stockholm or the DB-224 to Munich, and the latter has been delayed for 40 minutes. I've been on since midday as Carly has a stomach ache and went home. I don't mind. I never mind staying late. Humming softly to Celtic Pipes of the Emerald Isle, Volume 3, I walk over and collect the glasses from the two women who are peering intently at some video footage on a phone. They laugh the easy laugh of the well-lubricated. My granddaughter, 5 days old, says the blonde woman, as I reach over the table for her glass. Lovely, I smile. All babies look like currant buns to me. She lives in Sweden. I've never been. But I have to go and see my first grandchild, don't I?
We're wetting the baby's head.
They burst out laughing again. Join us in a toast?
Go on, take the load off for 5 minutes. We'll never finish this bottle in time.
Oops, here we go. Come on, door. Alerted by a screen, they gather up their belongings, and perhaps it's only me who notices a slight stagger as they brace themselves for the walk towards security. I place their glasses on the bar and scan the room for anything else that needs washing.
You never tempted, then.
The smaller woman has turned back for her scarf.
I'm sorry? To just walk down there at the end of a shift. Hop on a plane.
I would, she laughs again. Every bloody day.
I smile, the kind of professional smile that might convey anything at all, and turn back towards the bar. Around me, the concession stalls are closing up for the night, steel shutters clattering down over the overpriced handbags and emergency gift Toblerones. The lights flicker off at gates 3, 5, 11. The last of the day's travellers winking their way into the night sky. Violet, the Congolese cleaner, pushes her trolley towards me, her walk a slow sway, her rubber-soled shoes squeaking on the shiny marmoleum.
Evening, darling.
Evening, Violet.
Ah, you shouldn't be here this late, sweetheart. You should be home with your loved ones.
She says exactly the same thing to me every night. Not long now. I respond with these exact words every night. Satisfied, she nods and continues on her way. Intense young laptop man and sweaty scotch drinker have gone. I finish stacking the glasses and cash up, checking twice until the till roll matches what's in the drawer. I note everything in the ledger, check the pumps, jot down what we need to reorder. It is then that I notice the big man's coat is still over his bar stool. I walk over and glance up at the monitor. The flight to Munich would be just boarding. If I felt inclined to run his coat down to him, I look again, then walk slowly to the gents.
Hello? Is anyone in here?
The voice that emerges is strangled and bears a faint edge of hysteria. I push the door. The scotch drinker is bent low over the sink, splashing in his face. His skin is chalk white.
Are they calling my flight?
It's only just gone up. You've probably got a few minutes. I make to leave, but something stops me. The man is staring at me, his eyes two tight little buttons of anxiety.
I can't do it.
He grabs a paper towel and pats at his face.
I can't get on the plane.
I wait.
I'm meant to be travelling over to meet my new boss, and I can't.
I haven't had the guts to tell him I'm scared of flying.
He shakes his head.
Not scared. Terrified.
I let the door close behind me. What's your new job?
He blinks. Car parts. I'm the new senior regional manager, bracket, spares, close bracket, for Hunt Motors.
Sounds like a big job, I say. You have brackets.
I've been working for it a long time.
He swallows hard.
Which is why I don't want to die in a ball of flame.
I really don't want to die in an airborne ball of flame. I'm tempted to point out that it wouldn't actually be an airborne ball of flame. More a rapidly descending one, but suspect it wouldn't really help. He splashes his face again and I hand him another paper towel.
Thank you.
He lets out a shaky breath and straightens, attempting to pull himself together.
I bet you never saw a grown man behave like an idiot before, huh?
About 4 times a day. His tiny eyes widen. About 4 times a day, I have to fish someone out of the men's loos, and it's usually down to a fear of flying. He blinks at me. But, you know, like I say to everyone else, no planes have ever gone down from this airport.
His neck shoots back in his collar. Really?
Not one.
Not even a little crash on the runway?
I shrug. It's actually pretty boring here. People fly off, go to where they're going, and come back again a few days later. I lean against the door to prop it open.
These lavatories never smell any better by the evening.
And anyway, personally, I think there are worse things that can happen to you.
Well, I suppose that's true.
He considers this and looks sideways at me.
4 a day, huh?
Sometimes more. Now, if you wouldn't mind, I really have to get back. It's not good for me to be seen coming out of the men's loos too often. He smiles, and for a minute I can see how he might be in other circumstances. A naturally ebullient man. A cheerful man. A man at the top of his game, of continentally manufactured car parts. Oh, you know, I think I can hear them calling your flight.
You reckon I'll be okay?
You'll be okay. It's a very safe airline, and it's just a couple of hours out of your life.
Look, the SK-491 landed 5 minutes ago. As you walk to your departure gate, you'll see the air stewards and stewardesses coming through on their way home, and you'll see them all chatting and laughing.
For them, getting on these flights is pretty much like getting on a bus. Some of them do it 2, 3, 4 times a day, and they're not stupid. If it wasn't safe, they wouldn't get on, would they?
Like getting on a bus, he repeats.
Probably a lot safer.
Well, that's for sure. He raises his eyebrows. Lots of idiots on the road.
I nod. He straightens his tie.
And it is a big job.
Oh, shame to miss out on it for such a small thing. You'll be fine once you get used to being up there again.
Maybe I will.
Thank you. Louisa, I say.
Thank you, Louisa. You're a very kind girl.
He looks at me speculatively.
I don't suppose you'd like to go for a drink sometime.
Oh, I think I hear them calling your flight, sir, I say, and open the door to allow him to pass through. He nods to cover his embarrassment and makes a fuss of patting his pockets.
Right, sure. Well, off I go then.
Enjoy those brackets. It's 2 minutes after he has left that I discover he's been sick, all over cubicle 3. I arrive home at 1:15 and let myself into the silent flat. I change into my pyjama bottoms and a hooded sweatshirt, then open the fridge, pull out a bottle of white, and pour a glass. It is lip-piercingly sour. I study the label and realised I must have opened it the previous night, then forgotten to put the top on the bottle, and decide it's never a good idea to think about these things too hard. I slump into a chair with it. On the mantelpiece there are 2 cards. One is from my parents wishing me a happy birthday. That best wishes from Mum is as piercing as any stab wound. The other is from my sister, suggesting that she and Tom come down for the weekend. It's 6 months old. 2 voicemails on my phone. One from my dentist, one not.
Hi, Louisa. It's Jared here. We met in the Dirty Duck.
Well, we hooked up.
Muffled, awkward laugh. It was just, I enjoyed it. I thought we could do it again. Well, you've got my digits.
When there is nothing left in the bottle, I consider buying another. But I don't want to go out again. I don't want Samir at the 24-hour grocery to make one of his jokes about my endless bottles of Pinot Grigio. I don't want to have to talk to anyone. I am suddenly bone-weary. It is the kind of head-buzzing exhaustion that tells me if I go to bed I won't sleep. I think briefly about Jared, and that he had oddly shaped fingernails. Am I bothered about oddly shaped fingernails? I stare at the bare walls of the living room and realise suddenly that what I actually need is air. I really need air. I open the hall window and climb unsteadily up the fire escape until I'm on the roof. The first time I came up, 9 months previously, the estate agent showed me how the previous tenants had made a small terrace garden up there, dotting around a few lead planters and a small bench.
"It's not officially yours, obviously," he said, "but yours is the only flat with direct access to it. I think it's pretty nice. You could even have a party up here."
I'd gazed at him, wondering if I really looked like the kind of person who held parties. The plants have long since withered and died. I'm apparently not very good at looking after things. Now I stand on the roof, staring out at London's winking darkness below. Around me a million people are living, breathing, eating, arguing. A million lives completely divorced from mine. It is a strange sort of peace. The sodium lights glitter as the sounds of the city filter up into the night air. Engines revving, doors slamming. Several miles south, the distant, brutalist thump of a police helicopter, its beams scanning the dark for some vanished miscreant in a local park. Somewhere in the distance, a siren. Always a siren.
"Won't take much to make this feel like home," the estate agent had said.
I had almost laughed. The city feels as alien to me as it always has. But then everywhere does these days. I hesitate, then take a step out onto the parapet, my arms lifted out to the side, a slightly drunken tightrope walker. One foot in front of the other, edging along the concrete, the breeze making the hairs on my outstretched arms prickle. When I first moved down here, when it all hit me hardest, I would sometimes dare myself to walk from one end to the other of my block. When I reached the other end, I would laugh into the night air.
"You see? I'm here, staying alive, right out on the edge. I'm doing what you told me."
It has become a secret habit. Me, the city skyline, the comfort of the dark, the anonymity, and the knowledge that up here nobody knows who I am. I lift my head, feeling the night breezes, hearing laughter below, the muffled smash of a bottle breaking, the traffic snaking up towards the city, seeing the endless red stream of taillights, an automotive blood supply. Only the hours between 3 and 5 a.m. are relatively peaceful, the drunks having collapsed into bed, the restaurant chefs having peeled off their whites, the pubs having barred their doors. The silence of those hours is interrupted only sporadically by the night tankers, the opening up of the Jewish bakery along the street, and the soft thump of the newspaper delivery vans dropping their paper bales. I know the subtlest movements of the city, because I no longer sleep. Somewhere down there a lock-in is going on in the White Horse, full of hipsters and EastEnders, and a couple are arguing outside. And across the city the General Hospital is picking up the pieces of the sick and the injured, and those who have just about scraped through another day. Up here is just the air, the dark, and somewhere the FedEx freight flight from LHR to Beijing, and countless travellers, like Mr. Scotch Drinker, on their way to somewhere new. 18 months. 18 whole months. "So when is it going to be enough?" I say into the darkness. And there it is. I can feel it boiling up again. The unexpected anger. I take 2 steps along, glancing down at my feet. Because this doesn't feel like living. Doesn't feel like anything. 2 steps. 2 more. I will go as far as the corner tonight.
"You didn't give me a bloody life, did you?"
"Not really.
You just smashed up my old one. You smashed it into little pieces. And what am I meant to do with what's left? When is it going to feel?"
I stretch out my arms, feeling the cool night air against my skin, and realise I'm crying again.
"Fuck you, Will,"
I whisper.
"Fuck you for leaving me."
Grief wells up again, and like a sudden tide, intense, overwhelming. And just as I feel myself sinking into it, a voice says from the shadows, "I don't think you should stand there." I half turn and catch a flash of a small pale face on the fire escape. Dark eyes wide open. And in shock, my foot slips on the parapet and my weight suddenly the wrong side of the drop. My heart lurches a split second before my body follows. And then, like a nightmare, I am weightless. In the abyss of the night air. My legs flailing above my head as I hear the shriek that may be my own. Crunch. And then all is black. Chapter 2. "What's your name, sweetheart?" A brace around my neck. A hand feeling around my head. Gently, swiftly. I am alive. This is actually quite surprising. "That's it. Open your eyes. Right, look at me. Now. Look at me. Can you tell me your name?" I want to speak. To open my mouth, but my voice emerges muffled and nonsensical. I think I've bitten my tongue. There is blood in my mouth, warm and tasting of iron. I cannot move. "We're going to put you onto a spinal board, okay? You may be a bit uncomfortable for a minute, but I'm going to give you some morphine to make the pain a bit easier." The man's voice is calm, level, as if it is the most normal thing in the world to be lying broken on concrete, staring up at the dark sky. I want to laugh. I want to tell him how ridiculous it is that I'm here. But nothing seems to work as it should. The man's face disappears from view. A woman in a neon jacket, her dark curly hair tied back in a ponytail, looms over me and shines a thin torch abruptly in my eyes, gazing at me with the same detached interest as if I was a specimen, not a person. "Do we need to bag her?" I want to speak, but I'm distracted by the pain in my legs. "Jesus," I say, but I'm not sure if I say it aloud. "Multiple fractures, pupils normal and reactive, BP 90 over 60. She's lucky she hit that awning. What are the odds of landing on a daybed, eh?" I don't like that bruising, though. Cold air on my midriff. The light touch of warm fingers. "Internal bleeding? Do we need a second team? Can you step back, please, sir? Right back." Another man's voice. "I came outside for a smoke and she dropped on my bloody balcony. She nearly bloody landed on me." "Well, there you go. It's your lucky day she didn't. I got the shock of my life. You don't expect people to just drop out of the bloody sky. Look at my chair. That was £800 from the Conran shop. Do you think I can claim for it?" A brief silence. "You can do what you want, sir. Tell you what, you could charge her for cleaning the blood off your balcony while you're at it. How about that?" The first man's eyes slide towards his colleague. Time slips, and I tilt with it. I've fallen off a roof. My face is cold, and I realise distantly that I'm starting to shake. "She's going into shock, Sam." A van door slides open somewhere below, and then the board beneath me moves, and briefly, oh, the pain, the pain, the pain. Everything turns black. A siren and a swirl of blue, always a siren in London. We are moving. Neon slides across the interior of the ambulance, hiccups and repeats, illuminating the unexpectedly packed interior. The man in the green uniform, who is tapping something into his phone before turning to adjust the drip above my head. Pain has lessened. Morphine? But with consciousness comes growing terror. A giant airbag is inflating slowly inside me, steadily blocking out everything else. Oh no. Oh no. "Excuse me." Takes two goes for the man, his arm braced against the back of the cab to hear me. He turns and stoops towards my face. He smells of lemons, and he has missed a bit when shaving. "Are you okay there?"
"I..."
The man leans down. "Sorry, it's hard to hear over the siren. We'll be at the hospital soon." He places a hand on mine. It is dry and warm and reassuring. I'm suddenly panicked in case he decides to let go.
"Just hang on in there. What's our ETA, Donna?"
I can't say the words. My My tongue fills my mouth. My thoughts are muddled, overlapping. Did I move my arms when they picked me up? I lifted my right hand, didn't I?
And I got a light.
It emerges as a whisper. What? He drops his ear to somewhere near my mouth.
Caroline. And I... Caroline.
Paralyzed? The man hesitates, his eyes on mine, then turns and looks down at my legs.
Can you wiggle your toes?
I try to remember how to move my feet. It seems to require several more leaps of concentration than it used to. The man reaches down and lightly touches my toe, as if to remind me where they are.
Try again. There you go.
Pain shoots up both my legs. A gasp, possibly a sob. Mine.
You're all right. Pain is good.
I can't say for sure, but I don't think there's any spinal injury. You've done your hip and a few other bits besides. His eyes are on mine. Kind eyes. He seems to understand how much I need convincing. I feel his hand close on mine. I have never needed a human touch more.
Really, I'm pretty sure you're not paralyzed.
Oh, thank God. I hear my voice, as if from afar. My eyes brim with tears. Please don't let go of me, I whisper. He moves his face closer.
I'm not letting go of you.
I want to speak, but his face blurs, and I'm gone again. Afterwards, they tell me I fell 2 floors of the 5, busting through an awning, breaking my fall on a top-of-the-range outsized canvas and wicker effect waterproof cushion sun lounger on the balcony of Mr. Anthony Gardner, a copyright lawyer and neighbour I've never met. My hip smashed into 2 pieces, and 2 of my ribs and my collarbone snapped straight through. I broke 2 fingers on my left hand and a metatarsal, which poked through the skin of my foot and caused one of the medical students to faint. My x-rays are a source of some fascination. I keep hearing the voice of the paramedic who treated me. You never know what will happen when you fall from a great height. I am apparently very lucky. They tell me this and wait, smiling as if I should respond with a huge grin or perhaps a little tap dance. I don't feel lucky. I don't feel anything. I doze and wake, and sometimes the view above me is the bright lights of an operating theatre. And then it is a quiet, still room. A nurse's face, snatches of conversation. Oh, did you see the mess the old woman on D4 made? That's some end of a shift, eh?
You work up at the Princess Elizabeth, right? You can tell them we know how to run an ER.
You just rest now, Louisa. We're taking care of everything. Just rest now. Morphine makes me sleepy. They up my dose and it's a welcome cold trickle of oblivion. I open my eyes to find my mother at the end of my bed.
She's awake! Bernard! She's awake! Do we need to get the nurse?
She's changed the colour of her hair, I think, distantly. And then... Oh. It's my mother. My mother doesn't talk to me anymore.
Oh, thank God! Thank God!
My mother reaches up and touches the crucifix around her neck. It reminds me of someone, but I cannot think who. She leans forward and lightly strokes my cheek. For some reason, this makes my eyes fill immediately with tears. Oh, my little girl. She is leaning over me as if to shelter me from further damage. I smell her perfume, as familiar as my own. Oh, Lou. She mops my tears with a tissue. I got the fright of my life when they called.
Are you in pain? Do you need anything? Are you comfortable? What can I get you?
She talks so fast that I cannot answer.
We came as soon as they said. Trina's looking after Grandad and he sends his love. Well, he sort of made that noise, you know, but we all know what he means. Oh, love, how on earth did you get yourself into this mess? What on earth were you thinking?
She doesn't seem to require an answer. All I have to do is lie here. My mother dabs at her eyes and again at mine. You're still my daughter. And I couldn't bear it if something happened to you and we weren't... You know. I swallow the words. My tongue feels ridiculous. I sound drunk.
I never want...
I know. But you made it so hard for me, Lou. I couldn't...
Not now, love, eh?
Dad touches her shoulder. She looks away into the middle distance and takes my hand.
When we got the call, I didn't know.
She's sniffing again, her handkerchief pressed to her lips.
Oh, thank God she's okay, Bernard.
Course she is. Made of rubber, this one, eh?
Dad looms over me. We had last spoken on the telephone 2 months previously, but I haven't seen him in person for the 18 months since I left my hometown. He looks enormous and familiar, and desperately, desperately tired.
Sorry,
I whisper. I can't think of what else to say.
Don't be daft. We're just glad you're okay. Even if you do look like you've done 6 rounds with Mike Tyson. Have you seen yourself in a mirror since you got here?
I shake my head.
Maybe. I might just hold off a bit longer. You know Terry Nichols, that time he went right over his handlebars by the mini-mart? Well, take off the moustache and that's pretty much what you look like. Actually,
he peers closer at my face.
Now you mention it.
Bernard.
We'll bring you some tweezers tomorrow. Anyway, the next time you decide you want flying lessons, let's head down the old airstrip, yeah? Jumping and flapping your arms is plainly not working for you.
I try to smile. They both bend over me. Their faces are strained, anxious. My parents.
She's got thin, Bernard. Don't you think she's got thin?
Dad leans closer. And then I see his eyes are a little watery. His smile a bit wobblier than usual.
No. She looks beautiful, love. Believe me. You look bloody beautiful.
He squeezes my hand, then lifts it to his mouth and kisses it. My dad has never done anything like that to me in my whole life. It is then that I realise they thought I was going to die, and a sob bursts unannounced from my chest. I shut my eyes against the hot tears and I feel his large, wood-roughened palm around mine. We're here, sweetheart.
It's all right now. It's all going to be okay.
They make the 50-mile journey every day for 2 weeks, catching the early train down, and then after that, every few days. Dad gets special dispensation from work, and because Mum won't travel by herself. There are, after all sorts in London. This is said more than once, and always accompanied by a furtive glance behind her, as if a knife-wielding hood is even now sneaking into the ward. Trina is staying over to keep an eye on Grandad. There is an edge to the way Mum says it that makes me think this might not be my sister's first choice of arrangements. Mum brings homemade food and has done so since the first day we all stared at my lunch and, despite 5 minutes of intense speculation, couldn't work out what it was.
And in plastic trays, Bernard. It's like a prison.
She prodded it sadly with a fork, then sniffed it. Since then, she has arrived with enormous sandwiches, thick slices of ham or cheese in white bloomer bread, homemade soups in flasks,
food you can recognise,
and feeds me like a baby. My tongue slowly returns to its normal size. Apparently, I had almost bitten through it when I landed. It's not unusual, they tell me. I've had 2 operations to pin my hip, and my left foot and my left arm are in plaster up to the joints. Keith, one of the porters, asks if he can sign my casts. Apparently it's bad luck to have them virgin white, and promptly writes a comment so filthy that Evelyn, the Filipina nurse, has to put a plaster on it before the consultant comes round. When he pushes me to X-ray or to the pharmacy, he tells me the gossip from around the hospital. I could do without hearing about the patients who die slowly and horribly, of which there seems to be an endless number, but it keeps him happy. I sometimes wonder what he tells people about me. I am the girl who fell off a 5-story building and lived. In hospital status, this apparently puts me somewhere above the compacted bowel and seaboard, or that daft bint who accidentally took her thumb off with pruning shears. It's amazing how quickly you become institutionalised. I wake, accept the ministrations of a handful of people I now recognise, try to say the right thing to the consultants, and wait for my parents to arrive. My parents keep busy with small tasks in my room, and become uncharacteristically deferential in the face of the doctors. Dad apologises repeatedly for my inability to bounce, until Mum kicks him quite hard in the ankle. After the rounds are finished, Mum usually has a walk around the concourse shops downstairs, and returns exclaiming in hushed tones at the number of fast food outlets. That one-legged man from the cardio ward, Bernard, sitting down there stuffing his face with cheeseburger and chips like you wouldn't believe. Dad sits and reads the local paper in the chair at the end of my bed. The first week he keeps checking it for reports of my accident. I try to tell him that in this part of the city even double murders barely merit a news in brief. But in Stortfold, the previous week the local paper's front page ran with supermarket trolleys left in wrong area of car park. And the week before that it was schoolboy sad at state of duck pond. So he has yet to be convinced. On the Friday after the final operation on my hip, my mother brings a dressing gown that is one size too big for me and a large brown paper bag of egg sandwiches. I don't have to ask what they are. The sulphurous smell floods the room as soon as she opens her bag. My father wafts his hand in front of his nose.
The nurses will be blaming me, Josie,
he says, opening and closing my door. Eggs will build her up. She's too thin. And besides, you can't talk. You were blaming the dog for your awful smells 2 years after he'd actually died.
Just keeping the romance alive, love.
Mum lowers a voice. Trina says her last fellow put the blankets over her head when he blew wind. Can you imagine? Dad turns to me.
When I do it, your mother won't even stay in the same postcode.
There is tension in the air, even as they laugh. I can feel it. When your whole world shrinks to four walls, you become acutely attuned to slight variations in atmosphere. It's the way the consultants turn away slightly when they're examining x-rays, or the nurses cover their mouths when they're talking about someone nearby who has just died. What? I say. What is it? They look awkwardly at each other. So, Mum sits on the edge of my bed. The doctor said, the consultant said, it's not clear how you fell. I bite into an egg sandwich. I can pick things up with my left hand now. Oh, that, I got distracted. While walking around a roof? I chew for a minute. Is there any chance that you were sleepwalking, sweetheart? Dad, I've never sleepwalked in my life. Yes, you have. There was that time when you were 13 and you sleepwalked downstairs and ate half of Trina's birthday cake. I may not have actually been asleep. And there's your blood alcohol level. They said that you were drunk. An awful lot. I'd had a tough night at work. I had a drink or two and I just went up on the roof to get some air. And then I got distracted by a voice. You heard a voice? I was standing on the top looking out. I do it sometimes. And there was this girl's voice behind me and it gave me a shock and I lost my footing. A girl? Well, I only really heard her voice. Dad leans forward. You're sure that it was an actual girl, not an imaginary? It's my hip that's mashed up, Dad, not my brain. They did say it was a girl who called the ambulance. Mum touches Dad's arm. So you're saying that it really was an accident, he says. I stop eating. They look away from each other guiltily. What? You think I jumped off?
We're not saying anything. Dad scratches his head. It's just, well, things have all gone so wrong since, and we hadn't seen you for so long, and we were a bit surprised that you'd be up walking on the roof of a building in the wee hours. You used to be afraid of heights.
I used to be engaged to a man who thought it was normal to calculate how many calories he'd burnt while he slept. Jesus, this is why you've been so nice to me. You think I tried to kill myself?
It's just he was asking us all sorts.
Who was asking what?
Well, the psychiatrist bloke. They just want to make sure that you're okay, love. We know things have been all... Well, you know, since... Psychiatrist. They're putting you on a waiting list to see someone to talk, you know. And we've had a long chat with the doctors and you're coming home with us just while you recover. You can't stay by yourself in that flat of yours. It's...
You've been to my flat?
Well, we had to fetch your things.
There is a long silence. I think of them standing in my doorway, my mother's hands tight on a bag as she surveyed the unwashed bed linen, the empty wine bottles lined up in a row on the mantelpiece, the solitary half bar of fruit and nut in the fridge. I picture them shaking their heads, looking at each other.
Are you sure we've got the right place, Bernard? Right now, you need to be with your family. just till you're back on your feet.
I want to say that I'll be fine in my flat, no matter what they think of it. I want to do my job and come home and not think until my next shift. I want to say I can't come back to Stortfold and be that girl again. The one who... I don't want to have to feel the weight of my mother's carefully disguised disapproval, of my father's cheerful determination, that it's all okay, everything is just fine. As if saying it enough times will actually make it okay. I don't want to pass Will's house every day, to think about what I was part of, the thing that will always be there. But I don't say any of it, because suddenly I'm tired, and everything hurts. And I just can't fight anymore. Dad brings me home 2 weeks later in his work van. There is only room for two in the front, so Mum has stayed behind us to prepare the house. And as the motorway speeds beneath us, I find my stomach tightening nervously. The cheerful streets of my hometown feel foreign to me now. I look at them with a distant, analytical eye, noticing how small everything looks, how tired, how twee. I realise this is how Will must have seen it when he first came home after his accident, and pushed the thought away. As we drive down our street, I find myself sinking slightly into my seat. I don't want to make polite conversation with neighbours, to explain myself. I don't want to be judged for what I did.
You okay?
Dad turns as if he's guessed something of what's going through my head. Fine. Good girl. He puts a hand briefly on my shoulder. Mum is already at the door as we pull up. I suspect she's been standing by the window for the past half hour. Dad puts one of my bags on the step, then comes back to help me out, hoisting the other over his shoulder. I place my cane carefully on the paving stones and feel the twitching of curtains behind me as I make my way slowly up the path.
Look who it is,
I can hear them whispering.
What do you think she's done now?
Dad steers me forward, watching my feet carefully as if they might suddenly shoot out and go somewhere they shouldn't.
Okay there, he keeps saying. Not too fast now.
I could see Grandad hovering behind Mum in the hall, wearing his checked shirt and his good blue jumper. Nothing has changed. The wallpaper is the same. The hall carpet is the same. The lines in the worn pile visible from where Mum must have vacuumed that morning. I can see my old blue anorak hanging on the hook. 18 months. Feel as if I've been away for a decade.
Don't rush her,
Mum says, her hands pressed together.
You're going too fast, Bernard. She's hardly flipping Mo Farah. If she goes any slower, we'll be moonwalking. Watch those steps. Should you stand behind her, Bernard, coming up the steps, you know, in case she falls backwards?
I know where the steps are, I say through gritted teeth. I only lived here for 26 years.
Watch she doesn't catch herself on that lip there, Bernard. You don't want her to smash the other hip.
Oh, God, I think. Is this what it was like for you, Will? Every single day. And then my sister's in the doorway pushing past Mum.
Oh, for God's sake, Mum. Come on, hop along. You're turning us into a freaking sideshow.
Trina wedges her shoulder under my armpit and turns briefly to glare out at the neighbours. Her eyebrows raised as if to say, really? I can almost hear the swishing of curtains as they close.
Bunch of bloody rubberneckers. Anyway, hurry up. I promised Thomas he could see your scars before I take him to youth club. God, how much weight have you lost? Your boobs must look like two tangerines in a pair of socks.
It's hard to laugh and walk at the same time. Thomas runs to hug me so that I have to stop and put a hand against the wall to keep my balance as we collide.
Did they really cut you open and put you back together? He says.
His head comes up to my chest. He's missing 4 front teeth.
Grandpa says they probably put you back together all the wrong way, and God only knows how we'll tell the difference. Bernard!
I was joking.
Louisa?
Grandad's voice is thick and hesitant. He reaches forward unsteadily and hugs me, and I hug him back. He pulls away, his old hands gripping my arms surprisingly tight, and frowns at me, a mock anger.
I know, Daddy, I know. But she's home now, says Mum. You're back in your old room, says Dad. I'm afraid we redecorated with Transformers wallpaper for Tom. You don't mind the odd Autobot and Predacon, right? I had worms in my bottom, says Thomas, Mum says I'm not to talk about it outside the house, or put my fingers up my... Oh, good Lord, says Mum.
Welcome home, Lou, says Dad, and promptly drops my bag on my foot.
Chapter 3. Looking back, for the first 9 months after Will's death, I was in a kind of daze. I went straight to Paris and simply didn't go home, giddy with freedom, with the appetites that Will had stirred in me. I got a job at a bar favoured by expats where they didn't mind my terrible French, and I grew better at it. I rented a tiny attic room in the 16th above a Middle Eastern restaurant, and I would lie awake, listening to the sound of the late drinkers and the early morning deliveries, and every day I felt like I was living someone else's life. Those early months, it was as if I had lost a layer of skin. I felt everything more intensely. I woke up laughing or crying, saw everything as if a filter had been removed. I ate new foods, I walked strange streets, spoke to people in a language that wasn't mine. Sometimes I felt haunted by him, as if I was seeing it all through his eyes. I heard his voice in my ear.
What do you think of that then, Clark? I told you you'd love this. Eat it. Try it. Go on.
I felt lost without our daily routines. It took weeks for my hands not to feel useless without daily contact with his body. The soft shirt I would button, the warm, motionless hands I would wash gently, the silky hair I could still feel between my fingers. I missed his voice, his abrupt, hard-earned laugh, the feel of his lips against my fingers, the way his eyelids would lower when he was about to drop off to sleep. My mother, still aghast at what I had been part of, had told me that while she loved me, she could not reconcile this Louisa with the daughter that she had raised. So with the loss of my family, as well as the man I had loved, every thread that had linked me to who I was had been cut off. I felt as if I had simply floated off, untethered to some unknown universe. So I acted out a new life. I made casual, arm's-length friendships with other travellers. Young English students on gap years, Americans retracing the steps of literary heroes, certain they would never return to the Midwest. Wealthy young bankers, day trippers, the constantly changing cast that drifted in and through and past. Escapees from other lives. I smiled and I chatted and I worked. And I told myself I was doing what he wanted. That there had to be comfort, at least in that. Winter loosened its grip and the spring was beautiful. Then almost overnight I woke up one morning and realised I'd fallen out of love with the city. Or at least I didn't feel Parisian enough to stay. The stories of the expats began to sound wearyingly similar. The Parisians to seem unfriendly, or at least I noticed several times a day, the myriad ways in which I would never quite fit in. The city, compelling as it was, felt like a glamorous couture dress that I had bought in haste but didn't quite fit me after all. I handed in my notice and went travelling around Europe. No 2 months had ever left me feeling more inadequate. I was lonely almost all the time. I hated not knowing where I was going to sleep each night, was permanently anxious about train timetables and currency, and found it difficult to make friends when I didn't trust anyone I met. And what could I say about myself anyway? When people asked me, I could give them only the most cursory details. All the stuff that was important or interesting about me was what I couldn't share. Without someone to talk to, every sight I saw, whether it was the Trevi Fountain or a canal in Amsterdam, felt simply like a box I'd needed to tick on a list. I spent the last week on a beach in Greece that reminded me too much of a beach I'd been on with Will not too long before. And finally, after a week of sitting on the sand, fending off bronzed men who all seemed to be called Dimitri, and trying to tell myself I was actually having a good time, I gave up and I returned to Paris. Mostly because that was the first time it had occurred to me that I had nowhere else to go. For 2 weeks I slept on the sofa of a girl I'd worked with at the bar, while I tried to decide what to do next. Recalling a conversation I'd had with Will about careers, I wrote to several colleges about fashion courses, but I had no history of work to show them, and they rebuffed me politely. The place on the course I had originally won after Will died had been awarded to someone else because I had failed to defer. I could apply again next year, the administrator said, in the tones of someone who knew I wouldn't. I looked online at jobs websites and saw that, despite everything I had been through, I was still unqualified for the kind of jobs I might be interested in doing. And then by chance, just as I was wondering what to do next, Michael Lawler, Will's lawyer, rang me and suggested it was time to do something with the money Will had left. It was the excuse to move that I needed. He helped me negotiate a price on a scarily expensive two-bedroom flat on the edge of the square mile, which I bought largely because I remembered Will once talking about the wine bar on the corner, which made me feel a bit closer to him. And there was a little left over with which to furnish it. 6 weeks later, I came back to England, got a job at the Shamrock and Clover, slept with a man called Phil I would never see again, and waited to feel as if I had really started living. 9 months on, I was still waiting. I didn't go out much that first week home. I was sore and I grew tired quickly, so it was easy to lie in bed and doze, wiped out by extra-strength painkillers, and tell myself that letting my body recover was all that mattered. In a weird way, being back in our little family house suited me. It was the first place I had managed to sleep more than 4 hours at a stretch since I had left. It was small enough that I could always reach out for a wall to support myself. Mum fed me. Grandad kept me company. Trina had gone back to college, taking Tom with her. And I watched a lot of daytime television, marvelling at its never-ending advertisements for loan companies and stair lifts, and its preoccupations with minor celebrities that the best part of a year abroad had left me unable to recognise. It was like being in a little cocoon, one that, admittedly, had a whacking great elephant squatting in its corner. We didn't talk about anything that might upset this delicate equilibrium. I would watch whatever celebrity news daytime television threw up and then say at supper, "Well, what about that Shayna West then, eh?" And Mum and Dad would leap on the topic gratefully, remarking that she was a trollop, or had nice hair, or that she was no better than she should be. We covered bargains in your attic. "I always wonder what that Victorian planter of your mother's would have been worth. Oh, ugly old thing." And ideal homes in the country. "I wouldn't wash a dog in that bathroom." I didn't think beyond each mealtime, beyond the basic challenges of getting dressed, brushing my teeth and completing whatever tiny tasks my mother set me. "You know, love, when I'm out, if you could just sort your washing, I'll do it with my coloureds." But like a creeping tide, the outside world insisted steadily on intruding. I heard the neighbours asking questions of my mother as she hung out the washing. "Your loo home, then, is she?" And Mum's uncharacteristically curt response. "She is." I found myself avoiding the rooms in the house from which I could see the castle. But I knew it was there. The people in it living, breathing links to Will. Sometimes I wondered what had happened to them. While in Paris, I had been forwarded a letter from Mrs. Traynor, thanking me formally for everything I had done for her son. "I am conscious that you did everything you could." But that was it. The family had gone from being my whole life to a ghostly remnant of a time I wouldn't allow myself to remember. Now, as our streets sat moored in the shadow of the castle for several hours every evening, I felt the Traynor's presence like a rebuke. I'd been there 2 weeks before I realised that Mum and Dad no longer went to their social club. "Isn't it Tuesday?" I said on the third week as we sat around the dinner table. "Shouldn't you be gone by now?" They glanced at each other.
No, we're fine here,"
Dad said, chewing a piece of his pork chop. "I'm fine by myself, honestly," I told them. "I'm much better now and I'm quite happy watching television." I secretly longed to sit, unobserved, with nobody else in the room. I'd barely been left alone for more than half an hour at a time since I'd come home. "Really? Go out and enjoy yourselves. Don't mind me."
We don't really go to the club anymore," said Mum, as she sliced through a potato. "People, well, they had a lot to say about what went on," Dad shrugged. "In the end, it was just easier to stay out of it."
The silence that followed this lasted a full 6 minutes. And there were other, more concrete, reminders of the life I had left behind. Ones that wore skin-tight running pants with special wicking properties. It was on the fourth morning Patrick jogged past our house that I thought it might be more than coincidence. I had heard his voice the first day and limped blearily to the window, peering through the blind. And there he was below me, stretching out his hamstrings while talking to a blonde girl with a ponytail. She was clad in matching blue lycra so tight I could pretty much work out what she'd had for breakfast. They looked like two Olympians missing a bobsleigh. I stood back from the window in case he looked up and saw me, and within a minute they were gone again, jogging down the road, backs erect, legs pumping, like a pair of glossy turquoise carriage ponies. 2 days later I was getting dressed when I heard them. Patrick was saying something loudly about carb loading, and this time the girl flicked a suspicious glance towards my house, as if she were wondering why they had stopped in exactly the same place twice. On the third day, I was in the front room with Grandad when they arrived.
"We should practice sprints," Patrick was saying loudly. "Tell you what, you go to the third lamppost and back and I'll time you. 2 minute intervals, go!"
Grandad rolled his eyes meaningfully. "Has he been doing this the whole time I've been back?" Grandad's eyes rolled pretty much into the back of his head. I watched through the net curtains as Patrick stood, eyes fixed on his stopwatch, his best side presented to my window. He was wearing a black fleece zip-up top and matching lycra shorts, and as he stood, a few feet the other side of the curtain, I was able to gaze at him, quietly amazed that this was someone I had been sure for so long I loved.
"Keep going!" he yelled, looking up from the stopwatch, and like an obedient gun dog, the girl touched the lamppost beside him and bolted away again. 42.38 seconds, he said approvingly when she returned panting. "I reckon you could shave another 0.5 of a second off that."
"That's for your benefit," my mother said, who had walked in bearing two mugs. I did wonder. "His mother asked me in the supermarket, were you back, and I said you were."
"Oh, don't look at me like that. I could hardly lie to the woman."
She nodded towards the window.
"That one's had her boobs done. They're the talk of Stortfold. Apparently you could rest 2 cups of tea on them."
She stood beside me for a moment. "You know they're engaged." I waited for the pang, but it was so mild it could have been wind. "They look well suited." My mother stood there for a moment watching him.
"He's not a bad sort, Lou.
You just changed." She handed me a mug and turned away. Finally, on the morning he stopped to do press-ups on the pavement outside the house, I opened the front door and stepped out. I leaned against the porch, my arms folded across my chest, watching until he looked up.
"I wouldn't stop there for too long. Next door's dog is a bit partial to that bit of pavement."
"Lou!" he exclaimed, as if I was the very last person he expected to see standing outside my own house, which he had visited several times a week for the 7 years we had been together.
"Well, I'm surprised to see you back. I thought you were off to conquer the big wide world."
His fiancée, who was doing press-ups beside him, looked up, then back down at the pavement. It might have been my imagination, but her buttocks might have clenched even more tightly. Up, down, she bobbed furiously, up and down. I found myself worrying slightly for the welfare of her new bosom. He bounced to his feet.
"This is Caroline, my fiancée."
He kept his eyes on me, perhaps waiting for some kind of reaction.
"We're training for the next Ironman. We've done 2 together already."
"How, romantic," I said.
"Well, Caroline and I feel it's good to do things together," he said.
"So I see," I replied. "And his and hers, turquoise lycra.
Oh, yeah, team colour."
There was a short silence. I gave a little air punch. "Go team." Caroline sprang to her feet and began to stretch out her thigh muscles, folding her leg behind her like a stork. She nodded towards me, the least civility she could reasonably get away with.
"You've lost weight," he said.
"Yeah, well, a saline drip diet will do that to you."
"I heard you had, an accident."
He cocked his head sideways sympathetically. "News travels fast."
"Still, glad you're okay," he sniffed and looked down the road. "Must have been hard for you this past year, you know, doing what you did and all."
And there it was. I tried to keep control of my breathing. Caroline resolutely refused to look at me, extending her leg in a hamstring stretch. Then,
"Anyway, congratulations on the marriage."
He surveyed his future wife proudly, lost in admiration of her sinewy leg.
"Well, it's like they say, you just know when you know."
He gave me a faux apologetic smile. And that was what finished me off.
"I'm sure you did.
And I guess you've got plenty put aside to pay for the wedding. They're not cheap, are they?
They both looked at me.
What with you selling my story to the newspapers? What did they pay you, Pat? A couple of thousand? Trina never could find out the exact figure, but still. Will's death should be good for a few matching lycra onesies, right?
The way Caroline's face shot towards his told me this was one particular part of Patrick's story that he had not yet got around to sharing. He stared at me, two pinpricks of colour bleeding into his face.
That was nothing to do with me.
Of course not.
Nice to see you anyway, Pat. Good luck with the wedding. Caroline, I'm sure you'll be the firmest bride around.
I turned and walked slowly back inside. I closed the door, resting against it, heart thumping until I could be sure that they had finally jogged on.
Arse!
Said Grandad, as I limped back into the living room, and again glancing dismissively at the window.
Arse!
Then he chuckled. I stared at him, and completely unexpectedly I found I started to laugh, for the first time in as long as I could remember.
So did you decide what you're going to do, when you're better?
I was lying on my bed. Trina was calling from college while she waited for Thomas to come out of his football club. I stared up at the ceiling, on which Thomas had stuck a whole galaxy of day-glow stickers, which apparently nobody could remove without bringing half the ceiling with them. Not really.
Well, you've got to do something. You can't sit around here on your backside for all eternity.
I won't sit on my backside. Besides, my hip still hurts. The physio said I'm better off lying down. Mum and Dad are wondering what you're going to do. There are no jobs in Stortfold. I do know that. But you're drifting. You don't seem to be interested in anything. Trine, I just fell off a building. I'm recuperating.
And before that, you were wafting around travelling. And then you were working in a bar until you knew what you wanted to do. You'll have to sort your head out at some point. If you're not going back to school, you have to figure out what it is you're actually going to do with your life.
I'm just saying.
Anyway, if you're going to stay in Stortfold, you need to rent out that flat. Mum and Dad can't support you forever. Oh, and this from the woman who's been supported by the bank of Mum and Dad for the past 8 years. I'm in full-time education, that's different. So anyway, I went through your bank statements while you were in hospital, and after I'd paid all your bills, I worked out you've got about £1,500 left over, including statutory sick pay. Oh, by the way, what the hell were all those transatlantic phone calls? They cost you a fortune. It's none of your business. So I made you a list of estate agents in the area who do rentals. And then I thought maybe we could take another look at college applications. Someone might have dropped out of that course you wanted.
Oh, Trine, you're making me tired.
Look, no point hanging around. You'll feel better once you've got some focus.
For all it was annoying, there was something reassuring about my sister nagging at me. Nobody else dared to. It was as if my parents still believed there was something very wrong at the heart of me and that I must be treated with kid gloves. Mum laid my washing neatly folded on the end of my bed and cooked me 3 meals a day. And when I caught her watching me, she would smile, an awkward half-smile, which covered everything we didn't want to say to each other. Dad took me to my physio appointments, sat beside me on the sofa to watch television, and didn't even take the mickey out of me. Trina was the only one who treated me like she always had.
You know what I'm going to say to you, don't you?
I turned onto my side, wincing. I do and don't.
Well, you know what Will would have said. You had a deal and you can't back out of it. Okay, that's it, Trine. We're done with this conversation.
Fine. Tom's just coming out of the changing rooms. See you Friday, she said, as if she had just been talking about music or where she was going on holiday or soap. And I was left staring at the ceiling. You had a deal.
Yeah, and look how that turned out. For all Trina moaned at me, in the weeks that had passed since I'd come home, I had made some progress.
I'd stopped using the cane, which had made me feel around 89 years old, and which I had managed to leave behind in almost every place I'd visited since coming home. Most mornings I took Grandad for a walk around the park, at Mum's request. The doctor had instructed him to take daily exercise, but when she had followed him one day, she had found he was simply walking to the corner shop to buy a bumper pack of pork scratchings and eating them on a slow walk home. We walked slowly, both of us with a limp, and neither of us with any real place to be. Mum kept suggesting we do the grounds of the castle, for a change of scene, but I ignored her, and as the gate shut behind us each morning, Grandad nodded firmly in the direction of the park. It wasn't just because this way was shorter, or closer to the betting shop.
I think he knew I didn't want to go back there. I wasn't ready. I wasn't sure I'd ever be ready. We did 2 slow circuits of the duck pond and sat on a bench in the watery spring sunshine to watch the toddlers and their parents feeding the fat ducks, and the teenagers smoking, yelling and whacking each other, the helpless combat of early courtship. We took a stroll over to the bookies so Grandad could lose £3 on an each-way bet on a horse called Wag the Dog. Then, as he crumpled up his betting slip and threw it into the bin, I said I'd buy him a jam donut from the supermarket.
"Oh, fat,"
he said, as we stood in the bakery section. I frowned at him.
"Oh, fat,"
he said, pointing at our donuts and laughed.
"Oh, yeah, that's what we'll tell Mum. Low-fat donuts."
Mum said his new medication made him giggly. I had decided there were worse things that could happen to you. Grandad was still giggling at his own joke as we queued at the checkout. I kept my head down, digging in my pockets for change. I was thinking about whether I would help Dad with the garden that weekend. So it took me a minute to grasp what was being said in whispers behind me.
"It's the kilt. They say she tried to jump off a block of flats." "Well, you would, wouldn't you? I know I couldn't live with myself."
"I'm surprised she can show her face around here." I stood very still.
"You know, poor Josie Clark is still mortified. She goes to confession every single week, and you know that woman is as blameless as a line of clean laundry."
Grandad was pointing at the donuts and mouthing at the checkout girl.
"Oh, fat."
She smiled politely. 86 pence, please."
"The trainers have never been the same." "Well, it destroyed them, didn't it?"
86 pence, please." It took me several seconds to register that the checkout girl was looking at me, waiting. I pulled a handful of coins from my pocket. My fingers fumbled as I tried to sort through them.
"You think Josie wouldn't dare leave her in sole charge of her granddaddy, wouldn't you?" "You don't think she'd..." "Well, you don't know. She's done it the once after all."
My cheeks were flaming. My money clattered onto the counter and Grandad was still repeating,
"Oh, fat, oh, fat,"
at the bemused checkout girl, waiting for her to get the joke. I pulled at his sleeve. "Come on, Grandad, we have to go."
"Oh, fat,"
he insisted again.
"Right,"
she said and smiled kindly. "Please, Grandad." I felt hot and dizzy as if I might faint. They might still have been talking, but my ears were ringing so loudly I couldn't tell.
"Bye-bye," he said.
"Bye then," said the girl.
"Nice," said Grandad as we emerged into the sunlight.
Then, looking at me,
"Why are you crying?"
So here is the thing about being involved in a catastrophic life-changing event. You think it's just the catastrophic life-changing event that you're going to have to deal with. The flashbacks, the sleepless nights, the endless running over events in your head, asking yourself if you had done the right thing, said the things you should have said, whether you could have changed things had you done it even a degree differently. My mother had told me that being with Will at the end would affect the rest of my life, and I had thought she meant me, psychologically. I thought she meant the guilt I would have to learn to get over, the grief, the insomnia, the weird, inappropriate bursts of anger, the endless internal dialogue with someone who wasn't even there. But now I saw it wasn't just me. In a digital age, I would be that person forever. Even if I managed to wipe the whole thing from my memory, I would never be allowed to disassociate myself from Will's death. My name would be tied to his for as long as there were pixels and a screen. People would form judgments about me based on the most cursory knowledge, or sometimes no knowledge at all, and there was nothing I could do about it. I cut my hair into a bob. I changed the way I dressed, bagging up everything that had ever made me distinctive and stuffing it into the back of my wardrobe. I adopted Trina's uniform of jeans and a generic T-shirt. Now when I read newspaper stories about the bank teller who had stolen a fortune, the woman who had killed her child, the sibling who had disappeared, I found myself not shuddering in horror as once I might have, but wondering instead at the story that hadn't made it into black and white. What I felt with them was a weird kinship. I was tainted. The world around me knew it. Worse, I had started to know it too. I tucked what remained of my dark hair into a beanie, put my sunglasses on and walked to the library, doing everything I could not to let my limp show, even though it made my jaw ache with concentration. I made my way past the singing toddler group in the children's corner, and the silent genealogy enthusiasts trying to confirm that, yes, they were distantly connected to King Richard III, and sat down in the corner with the files of local papers. It wasn't hard to locate August 2009. I took a breath, then opened them halfway and flicked through the headlines. Local man ends his life at Swiss clinic. Trainer family asked for privacy at difficult time.
The 35-year-old son of Stephen Trainer, custodian of Stortfield Castle, has ended his life at Dignitas, the controversial centre for assisted suicide. Mr. Trainer was left quadriplegic after a traffic accident in 2007. He apparently travelled to the clinic with his family and his carer, Louisa Clark, 27, also from Stortfield.
Police are investigating the circumstances surrounding the death. Sources say they have not ruled out the possibility that a prosecution may arise. Louisa Clark's parents, Bernard and Josephine Clark of Renfrew Road, refused to comment. Camilla Trainer, a justice of the peace, is understood to have stood down from the bench following her son's suicide. A local source said her position, given the actions of the family, had become untenable. And then there it was. Will's face, looking out from the grainy newspaper photograph. That slightly sardonic smile, the direct gaze. I felt briefly winded. Mr. Trainer's death ends a successful career in the city, where he was known as a ruthless asset stripper, but also as someone with a sure eye for a corporate bargain. His colleagues yesterday lined up to pay tribute to a man they described as... I closed the newspaper. When I could be sure that I had got my face under control, I looked up. Around me, the library hummed with quiet industry. The toddlers kept singing, their reedy voices chaotic and meandering, their mothers clapping fondly around them. The librarian behind me was discussing sotto voce with a colleague the best way to make Thai curry. The man beside me ran his finger down an ancient electoral roll, murmuring, Fisher, Fitzgibbon, Fitzwilliam. I had done nothing. It was more than 18 months, and I had done nothing, bar sell drinks in two different countries and feel sorry for myself. And now, after 4 weeks back in the house I'd grown up in, I could feel Stortfield reaching out to suck me in, to reassure me that I could be fine here. That it would be all right. There might be no great adventures, sure, and a bit of discomfort as people adjusted to my presence again, but there were worse things, right? Than to be with your family, loved and secure, safe. I looked down at the pile of newspapers in front of me. The most recent front page headline read, Row over disabled parking space in front of post office. I thought back to Dad sitting on my hospital bed, looking in vain for a report of an extraordinary accident. I failed you, Will. I failed you in every way possible. You could hear the shouting all the way up the street when I finally arrived home. As I opened the door, my ears were filled with the sound of Thomas wailing. My sister was scolding him, her finger wagging in the corner of the living room. Mum was leaning over Grandad with a washing-up bowl of water and a scouring pad, while Grandad politely battered her away. What's going on? Mum moved to the side and I saw Grandad's face clearly for the first time. He was sporting a new set of jet-black eyebrows and a thick, black, slightly uneven moustache. Permanent pen, said Mum. From now on, nobody is to leave Grandad napping in the same room as Thomas. You have to stop drawing on things, Trina was yelling. Paper only, okay? Not walls, not faces, and not Mrs. Reynolds' dog. Not my pants.
I was doing you days of the week.
I don't need days of the week pants, she shouted. And if I did, I would spell Wednesday correctly.
Oh, don't scold him, Trine, said Mum, leaning back to see if she'd had any effect. It could be a lot worse.
In our little house, Dad's footsteps coming down the stairs sounded like a particularly emphatic roll of thunder. He barreled into the front room, his shoulders hunched in frustration, his hair standing up on one side.
Can't a man get a nap in his own house on his day off? This place is like a ruddy madhouse.
We all stopped and stared at him.
What? What did I say?
Bernard.
Oh, come on. Our Lou doesn't think I mean her.
Oh, my sweet lord. Mum's hand flew to her face. My sister had started to push Thomas out of the room.
Oh, boy, she hissed. Thomas, you'd better get out of here right now, because I swear when your grandpa gets hold of you...
What? Dad frowned. What's the matter? Grandad barked a laugh. He held up a shaking finger. It was almost magnificent. Thomas had coloured in the whole of Dad's face with blue marker pen. His eyes emerged like two gooseberries from a sea of cobalt blue.
What?
Thomas's voice as he disappeared down the corridor was a wail of protest.
We were watching Avatar. He said he wouldn't mind being an avatar.
Dad's eyes widened. He strode to the mirror over the mantelpiece. There was a brief silence.
Oh, my God.
Bernard, don't take the Lord's name in vain. He's turned me bloody blue, Josie. I think I'm entitled to take the Lord's name to Butlins in a flipping wheelbarrow. Is this permanent pen? Tomo, is this permanent pen?
We'll get it off, Dad. My sister closed the door to the garden behind her. Beyond it, you could just make out Thomas's wailing.
I'm meant to be overseeing the new fencing at the castle tomorrow. I have contractors come in. How the hell am I meant to deal with contractors if I'm blue?
Dad spat on his hand and started to rub at his face. The faintest smudging appeared, but mostly seemed to spread onto his palm.
It's not coming off! Josie, it's not coming off!
Mum shifted her attention from Grandad and set about Dad with the scouring pad.
Just stay still, Bernard. I'm doing what I can.
Trina went for her laptop bag. I'll go on the internet. I'm sure there's something. Toothpaste or nail polish remover or bleach or...
You are not putting bleach on my ruddy face,
Dad roared. Grandad, with his new pirate moustache, sat giggling in the corner of the room. I began to edge past them. Mum was holding Dad's face with her left hand as she scrubbed. She turned as if she'd only just seen me.
Lou! Oh, I didn't ask. Are you okay, love? Did you have a nice walk?
Everyone stopped abruptly to smile at me. A smile that said, Everything's okay here, Lou. You don't have to worry. I hated that smile. Fine. It was the answer they all wanted. Mum turned to Dad.
That's grand. Isn't it grand, Bernard?
It is. Great news.
If you sort out your whites, love, I'll pop them in the wash for Daddy's later.
Actually, I said, don't bother. I've been thinking. It's time for me to go home. Nobody spoke. Mum glanced at Dad. Grandad let out another giggle and clapped his hand over his mouth.
Fair enough,
said Dad, with as much dignity as a middle-aged blueberry-coloured man could muster.
But if you go back to that flat, Louisa, you go on one condition.
Chapter 4
My name is Natasha, and I lost my husband to cancer 3 years ago.
On a humid Monday night, the members of the Moving On Circle sat in a ring of orange office chairs in the Pentecostal church hall, alongside Mark, the leader, a tall, mustachioed man whose whole being exuded a kind of exhausted melancholy, and one empty chair.
I'm Fred. My wife, Jilly, died in September. She was 74.
Sunil, my twin brother died of leukemia 2 years ago.
William, dead father, 6 months ago. A bit ridiculous, frankly, as we never really got on when he was alive. I keep asking myself why I'm here.
There was a peculiar scent to grief. It smelt of damp, imperfectly ventilated church halls and poor quality tea bags. It smelt of meals for one and stale cigarettes, smoked hunched against the cold. It smelt of spritzed hair and armpits, little practical victories against a morass of despair. That smell alone told me I did not belong there, whatever I had promised Dad. I felt like a fraud. Plus, they all looked so sad. I shifted uneasily in my seat and Mark caught me. He gave me a reassuring smile.
We know, it said. We've been here before.
I bet you haven't, I responded silently.
Sorry I'm late.
The door opened, letting in a blast of warm air, and the empty chair was taken up by a mop-headed teenager who folded his limbs into place, as if they were always somehow too long for the space they were in.
Jake, you missed last week. Is everything okay?
Sorry. Dad messed up at work and he couldn't get me here.
Don't worry. It's good you made it.
You know where the drink